Harborview, as you may know, is the Trauma One Center for Washington, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, and Alaska. We also have several inpatient psychiatry units, and we're the public county hospital, and therefore we serve many marginalized populations, including the underinsured and the uninsured. I'm a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, and sometimes doing chaplaincy from this unique perspective can be challenging. Over 90% of the patients I see are Christian, and sometimes when I'm praying to Jesus Christ for the 10th time in a row, it can be hard to make room for my own spirituality. Interestingly enough, most patients assume that I am what they are. Episcopalians assume I'm Episcopalian. Lutherans assume I'm Lutheran. Evangelicals assume I'm also evangelical. I enjoy working across faith lines, and yet I need to find ways to be authentic. Sometimes this can be a tricky dance. For example, a Southern Baptist family might ask me to pray for a miracle. I might start a prayer off in the family's tradition and add the asterisks in my own head, silently. Gracious God, holy mystery that I cannot define. Heavenly Father, and mother, and genderqueer parent and child. Sometimes these theological translations get a little clunky, but most of the time it works. People are in crisis, and I'm honored that they let me walk with them during those times. And yet, I don't want my own religious identity as a Unitarian Universalist to be made invisible. Working as a UU chaplain, I grapple with two main questions. One, how do I meet patients where they're at without losing my own spiritual voice? And two, how does my spirituality respond to the grief that I encounter? In the hospital, we are especially aware of the reality of suffering and tragedy. But the truth is, we all know those feelings. The tension between hopelessness and hope, between suffering and healing, exists in everyone's life. None of us is immune to grief or loss. You might be thinking of personal examples, loss of a job, of a loved one, of a dream. Or you might be thinking on a political or global scale, the violence we continue to inflict on one another and our planet. How does our spirituality make sense out of these heartbreaks? Well, first, I think we have to be honest about our grief and be willing to wade deeply into that discomfort. This can be challenging. It can be hard to sit with the question of suffering, not knowing if a response will come. As a good lifelong UU, I sometimes jump too quickly to the justice answer. It's like I'm still an 8-year-old sitting in the intergenerational service, wildly waving my hand around, ready with the answer. I know. We'll work together. We'll fight injustice. We'll make things better as a community. And that's true. We often place a lot of hope on humanity's ability to build a better world. But what happens when the reality of grief weighs us down? What happens when there's no solution to fix that heartbreak? I'm almost embarrassed to admit this because it seems so obvious, but during my first year at Harborview, one of the things I struggled with was the fact that so little is in my control. I can't prevent my patients from coming to the hospital, nor can I even contribute to the medical side of their treatment. Chaplains automatically show up at all cardiac arrests, and we're witnesses to the CPR. Whenever I am at these chaotic and messy events, I'm always itching to jump in. But that's not my job. I sit on the sidelines with family members waiting to see the outcome. And this is true for much of our lives. We can act, we can organize, we can stand up against injustice, and still, at the end of the day, much is out of our control. As I sit next to anguished family members and patients, it sometimes feels like I'm marching down into Dante's Inferno. Grief is like that. It is never simple or straightforward. It usually leads someone down twists and turns, into past regrets, into past losses, past hurt. In working with patients who just lost a loved one, I sometimes lead, sometimes stumble after them as we navigate the sharp edges and fast curves of their own hellish grief. Dante might have been right. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. And yet I can't. If I did, I probably would have trouble showing up to work each day. So too do Dante's characters march on. The Divine Comedy does not end in the frozen levels of hell. The two travelers emerge. They travel beyond those layers of suffering towards heaven, towards God, towards something beyond. Similarly, I don't believe that our pain defines our journeys. We too can move towards hope. But what does that look like? What does it mean to risk having hope? My previous supervisor often talked about the difference between wishing and hoping. As I wish for a certain outcome, I know that what I wish for might not be possible. Instead, I hope on a larger and more cosmic sense. For example, a husband might ask me to pray for his nearly brain-dead wife. He's begging me to pray for healing, that she makes a full recovery. Nevertheless, I've read the chart notes, I've spoken to the doctor. I know that this patient will most likely die. So how do I authentically respond to his request for prayer? This is when the nuance between wishes and hopes emerge. For me, wishing is much more concrete, while hoping spills over into the spiritual realm. When I wish for someone to survive, and when it's too late for that, I'm left with hoping that in her death she finds a sense of peace. I can hope that she dies knowing that she is loved. I can hope that her family finds healing and closure. Hope acknowledges the complexity and honors the fact that we are committing to the long process of healing each other and the world. I often work with patients who have suffered a lot of abuse throughout their lives. I once worked with a young child who faced a lot of hardship in her short life. I wanted to wish that she had never suffered, but it was too late for that. She had. Instead, I hoped that she would feel love even for just a moment. As her chaplain, I decided that the best spiritual care I could offer was to read books to her. A few days later, the nurses let me hold her, and as I cradled her, I spoke to her and sang to her. In those moments, I hoped that she could feel a sense of peace, of wholeness, of love. It can be hard to hope for those things. In the face of such suffering, hoping exposes some of our vulnerability. This kind of hoping means we have to confront the pain of what is lost. Perhaps you're familiar with this type of vulnerability and the lengths we often take to avoid it. This type of vulnerability admits that we are aching for something more. Looking for a new job might force you to admit that you're unhappy in your current one. Wanting more out of relationships might leave you wondering if you are enough. Talking about death might expose your concerns about the legacy you will leave behind. While it can hurt to stumble across these vulnerabilities, this is what it means to risk having hope. In naming our fears, we can claim our hopes. We need hope to survive, and we need one another to cultivate that. I see that cultivation of hope in our congregations, and I see it in the hospital. I see staff work tirelessly on behalf of their patients. I see families come together to offer unconditional support to one another. This is what beloved community means. A few months ago, I was in the room when a very young patient passed away. Surrounded by the parents' wails, it seemed like we were sinking quickly into the deepest levels of hell. Nevertheless, I found beauty in the fact that their four staff members sat in the room accompanying that family in their pain. This is where I saw the sacred amongst the suffering. We cannot rid the world of suffering. We can work together to lessen it, but in many ways we can't escape it. But I do find hope in how we respond to it. These four staff members, strangers to one another, came together in an act of beloved community. When a more theistic patient asks me if I think God is present in the hospital, I'm able to respond with an enthusiastic yes. It is in that showing up, in the love that we freely give one another, that I feel the presence of something transcendent and holy. We create that beloved community in our churches every Sunday. In witnessing each other's joys and sorrows, we cultivate that sacred spirit. It is this faith in our ability to foster communal hope, not just communal action, that allows me to pray even in the face of inevitable loss. Anne Lamont, a writer and author of one of her books called Traveling Mercies, frequently tackles the subject of prayer. She's a Christian and a theist. She prays all the time. And I think she would be the first one to admit that what she prays for and what she receives can be quite different. After worrying about her child's health, she prayed to God, hoped against hope, and surrounded herself with friends. After finally receiving good news, she wrote, quote, "God, I wish you could have some sort of permanence, a guarantee or two, the unconditional love we all long for." She writes that she often doesn't get an answer to that demand. Instead, she says, quote, "I have learned that most of the time, all you have is the moment and the imperfect love of people." In my work, in many of our efforts, our love can be imperfect. The hope I have for my patients and for the families and for all of us gathered here takes that long view. It demands my patience. It demands grace for the setbacks along the way. And it demands a trust in the next generation. It makes room for imperfection and invites us to take risks. This is one of the many reasons I need religion. I need community that nurtures vision for something more. Wishing can be futile. Hoping allows for something bigger than myself. Hope acknowledges the complexity of what I cannot control while still anticipating that another world is possible. Hope not only makes room for grace, but also invites others into that process. For me, this is where that possibility of beloved community emerges. It is here that I'm reminded of Adrienne Rich's poem, and I quote her, "My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those who age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world." In my work, in all of our work, we don't always know what that reconstitution will look like. We don't know how we will be renewed along the way. I continue with Anne Lamont, who writes that after she received good news, she calls a friend. She writes, quote, "He groaned with relief. Oh, honey, he said, and both of us were silent for a while. Then he said, sometimes deliverance is as cool as the air in the redwood grove." For me, deliverance can be that cool breeze or the awe-inspiring beauty of Mount Rainier. On the days that I'm having trouble naming my hope, I take a break, I go outside, and I stare at the mountain. She renews my hope mostly by reminding me that I'm so small. I'm not in control, and with that acknowledgement, I can start to foster my hope again. Like Anne, I too sometimes wish that someone would offer me a guarantee of permanence, that every person experiences unconditional love, that no one faces tragedy. But that is a wish that even while I name, I know is not a reality. So it is my hope that we can surround each other with imperfect love. And it is imperfect. Imperfect and deeply entrenched in the beloved community that we continually have to commit to rebuilding. It is amongst all of you that I pin my hopes, and I take solace in the voices that have spoken before me. Theologian Emily Towns writes about hope in her book, Womanist Ethics and the Cultural Production of Evil. And she says, quote, "Hope cannot simply be given a nod of recognition, for it demands not only a contract from us, but also a covenant and a commitment. When we truly live in this deep walking hope, then we must order and shape our lives in ways that are not always predictable, not always safe, and rarely conventional." Unquote. Imperfectly, foolishly, and unconventionally, we walk together, hoping for what we cannot yet see. I'm so glad and honored to walk with each one of you. May we leave here today knowing that we are not walking alone.